That which you've heard from Mark's gospel is, I think, one of the most pivotal teachings of Jesus. It gives us some insight into how Jesus was thinking and why he said and did the things that he did, because this he believed and this motivated him, that which causes us difficulty, that which threatens life, that which is the source of the evil in life, really is within us and not an external thing. I want to talk with you about that this morning, but I want to do it in a way that I don't always do. I want to tell you a couple of stories. And in those stories, I hope, give you a way to grasp onto what Jesus is trying to teach us in a way that will be helpful and that will be easier to remember. First, I'd like to tell you a story about me and Wendy. I didn't warn her about this, so she doesn't quite know what's coming. Happened a long time ago. We hadn't been married very long, and we didn't have any children yet. We lived in a big old house, big old parsonage. One of those with high ceilings and big windows. Even in the basement, there were big windows, and that's significant for the story. We were at home one summer night. It was late and it was dark. And we were working in our basement together on some project. At one point, Wendy looked at me and said, "I hear something upstairs." I told her that she was hearing things and went back to work. But then I thought better of it, and I thought, well, it'll only take a minute to run up there and check. And so I did. I went up the steps into the kitchen, through the kitchen into the dining room, and through the door into the living room. And from where I was standing, I could see all the way across the room that the front door was securely closed and locked. So I turned and went back downstairs, informing her that all was well and seemed to be secure. Of course, everything was fine. She was only hearing things. But not more than 2 minutes later, she looked at me again and said, "I hear someone walking through the dining room." That time I heard it too. So we ran up the stairs, right behind our fierce man-eating dog of 35 pounds. And again, found no one in the house and the front door securely closed and locked. When I went back through the house, though, into the kitchen, I stepped around the corner and looked at the back door. Then we began to piece together what had happened. The back door was not only open, but the screen door was propped open. And a metal cash box that we had had on the dining room table was sitting on the step. Wendy had indeed, and we figured out what had happened. Wendy had indeed heard someone the first time going through the house. And when I went upstairs, he or she heard me coming and hid. Probably they hid by lying down behind the sofa in the living room. So if I had gone over to the front door to check the door, I would undoubtedly have seen him there and would have had to put his lights out. I don't see what's so funny about that. And then the second time we heard him going back through the house and out the back door, we had come up the stairs and undoubtedly had almost seen him, almost caught him, because he was in such a hurry that he dropped the cash box on the step and headed out over the fence and away from us. We called the police to report that incident, and the officer said that we had undoubtedly figured out what had happened and that that sort of thing was becoming more and more common in town. Someone would see a couple sitting on the front porch, they'd go around the back and come in the back door. Or they'd see them in the upstairs through a window and they'd come in the main floor to find something valuable and take it. So we had figured it out. And by the way, the cash box was empty. We never had anything in it. What a disappointment, huh? Now, Yes. Now, I told you that story to ask you a question. How is it that we paid any attention to the faint noises we heard in the upstairs? Why did we do that? How is it that after it was all said and done, we were able to figure out what a burglar had done in our house and where he had come in and where he had gone and how he had moved and how he'd hidden? How were we able to do that? The police do it all the time. They go to the site of a crime and they can conclude by the shape of things and where things are. They can conclude that a criminal entered here and he went there and this or that was his purpose or plan. How can you and I do that? How can the police do that? How can we put ourselves in the place of a thief and imagine and figure out what they did? Well, perhaps you've figured out already the answer to that question is we can do that because in us there's a possible thief too. There is the same potential in me and in you, the same potential for that kind of cagey, sly, well-thought-out, destructive behavior. We have the same potential. Think of a person who is on trial for murder. Think of any of those plenty of television shows you see about that kind of thing these days. The prosecutor describes the crime and declares that the criminal acted through this or that motive, envy or jealousy or hate or greed. How does the attorney know that? How does the lawyer know out of what motive a criminal might have acted? Simply because the attorney, just like all of us, has experienced envy and jealousy and hate and greed himself. He knows what they feel like, and he knows what you can do in the grip of those emotions. That's how we can figure those things out when they happen, because the potential for them is within us too. It is because you and I share with one another this common nature of humanity that we can understand the things that we and others do. It is only because we have within us the same potential that we can imagine what others do with that potential. In Mark's gospel, we find one of those ancient insights that has shaped our understanding of what human beings are and how they work, because there we find stated one of Jesus' insights into what human beings are and how they work. The Pharisees and some of the teachers challenged Jesus regarding the way his followers were eating. They don't wash their hands in the prescribed manner. They are unsanitary. They are violating the law. Then Jesus, in characteristic manner, he took their argument and used it on them. There's nothing outside of a person which can come into them and make them dirty. But the things that come out of a person are what make them unclean. It is from within us that these evil things come that Jesus listed. Evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, envy, slander, pride, foolishness, and so on. All of those things have their seat within, and they defile a person. It's an inside job, you see. An inside job, an internal disorder that is at the root of all these things. Since last week was the beginning of school, there was a news report that repeated an old survey that was taken a good many years ago. And the survey stated these results. In the 1940s, the top 7 discipline problems in public schools were talking, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, wearing improper clothes, not putting paper in the wastebasket. Aren't those awful? In the 1990s, a survey listed these top 7 discipline problems in public schools: drug abuse, alcohol abuse, pregnancy, suicide, rape, robbery, and assault. What an incredible shift. Something is clearly wrong, clearly defiling us and our children. From chewing gum to drunkenness and drugs, from getting out of turn in line to getting out of life through suicide. And we get caught up, my friends, in blaming. We blame the country, we blame the school, we blame the liberals, we blame the conservatives, we blame the teachers. But all of that avoids what Jesus instructs. Look within. Look within yourself, within your family. That which threatens to undo us comes from within. That which has greatest potential to destroy us comes from within. That's where we start. Mrs. Thompson taught fifth grade. On the first day of school, there he was in the front row, the student that she had been dreading all summer, Teddy Stoddard. Mrs. Thompson had watched Teddy the year before and noticed that he didn't play well with the other children. His clothes were messy and he constantly needed a bath. And Teddy could be unpleasant to children and adults. It got to the point where Mrs. Thompson would actually take delight in marking Teddy's papers with a broad red pen with bold X's and then putting a big F at the top. At the school where Mrs. Thompson taught, she was required to review each child's past records. And she did so, but she put Teddy's record off until last. She just didn't want to face it. When she reviewed his file, though, she was surprised. Teddy's first grade teacher wrote this: "Teddy is a bright child with a ready laugh. He does his work neatly and has good manners. He is a joy to be around." His second grade teacher said this: "Teddy is an excellent student, well liked by his classmates. But he is troubled because his mother has a terminal illness and life at home must be a struggle." His third grade teacher: "His mother's death has been hard on him. He tries to do his best, but his father doesn't show much interest, and his home life will soon affect him if some steps aren't taken." Teddy's fourth grade teacher entered in his record: "Teddy is withdrawn and doesn't show much interest in school. He doesn't have many friends and sometimes sleeps in class." Well, by now, Mrs. Thompson realized the problem, and she was ashamed of herself for the way she had treated Teddy and the things she had thought of him. She felt even worse on the day when the students brought her Christmas presents, all wrapped in beautiful ribbons and bright paper, except for Teddy's present, which was clumsily wrapped in heavy brown paper, which used to be a grocery bag. Mrs. Thompson took pains to open Teddy's gift in the middle of all the other presents so it wouldn't stand out so much. When she opened the box, some of the children started to laugh because in it she found an old rhinestone bracelet with some of the stones missing and a bottle of perfume that was only one quarter full. But she stifled the children's laughter when she exclaimed how pretty the bracelet was and she put it on, and then she dabbed some of the perfume on her wrists as well. Teddy Stoddard stayed after school that day just long enough to say, "Mrs. Thompson, today you smell just like my mom used to." And after the children left, she cried. She wept. On that very day, she remembered the day and she could point to the exact moment. She said it made a difference in her that went far deeper than just one child. She said, "On that day, I stopped teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic. On that day, I started teaching children." Mrs. Thompson then paid particular attention to Teddy through the rest of the year. As she worked with him, his mind seemed to come alive. The more she encouraged him, the faster he responded, so that by the end of the year, he had become one of the brightest students in the class. A year later, she found a note under her door from Teddy, telling her that she was the best teacher he had had in his whole life. 6 years went by before she got another note from Teddy. He then wrote that he had finished high school, third in his class, and still she was the best teacher he had ever had. 4 years later, she got a letter saying that while things had been tough at times, he had stayed in school. He stuck with it and would soon graduate from college with honors. He assured Mrs. Thompson that she was still the best and favorite teacher he had had. Then 4 more years passed, and yet another letter came. This time he explained that after he had gotten his bachelor's degree, he decided to go a little further. But despite all the school, she was still his best and favorite teacher. But now his name was a little bit longer, and he signed his letter, Theodore F. Stoddard, M.D. But the story doesn't end there. There was one more letter that came from him. You see, he had met a young woman, and they were to be married. He explained in his letter to Mrs. Thompson that his father had died a couple of years ago, and he was wondering if she might come to his wedding and sit in the place that was usually reserved for the mother of the groom. And of course, Mrs. Thompson did so. And you know what she did, don't you? She wore that old rhinestone bracelet with a couple of the stones missing, and she made sure she was wearing some of that perfume that Teddy remembered his mother wearing on their last Christmas together. They hugged each other after the service, and Dr. Stoddard whispered in Mrs. Thompson's ear, "Thank you, Mrs. Thompson, for believing in me. Thank you so much for making me feel important and showing me that I could make a difference." But Mrs. Thompson responded with tears in her eyes. She said, "Teddy, you have it all wrong. You don't understand at all. You are the one who taught me that I could make a difference. I didn't know how to teach until I met you." If only it were as simple as fixing schools, fixing a nation, replacing the leadership, restructuring the administration. If only it were so simple. But Jesus tells us there's nothing outside a person that going in can defile them. But it is the things within that make all the trouble. It is within us that change is needed, that the transforming and the fixing must be done. And you and I, good as we are at life, successful as we are, you and I cannot put it off on others, imagining ourselves to be good and clean and pure. Like the teacher who didn't know what was wrong until she met a particular student, you won't know what's wrong either until you meet Jesus. I do not fully understand the transformation that Jesus works in the human heart, and I'll be the first to tell you that it is an ongoing process that Jesus works in me day by day, and some days are better than others. I do know that you won't know what's wrong until you meet Jesus, until you allow him to take hold of you and work within you the miraculous transforming work that only he can work in the human heart. And so today, if you've not been invited before, I invite you now to meet this Jesus whom we worship, to place your hand in his, to begin to know who he is. Perhaps you've not done that before. Perhaps you have, and you've gotten away from that friendship and that relationship. And so I invite you now to acquaint yourself with this Jesus who seeks you, who is ever waiting to be your friend and mine. And more than that, if you do so, I invite you and encourage you to tell somebody about it. Tell one of your pastors. Tell this, you know, First Church is just filthy with clergy. They're all over the place. Right, George? But you don't have to talk to a pastor. or a reverend. Talk to anyone. Someone who can hear about your journey and help you understand what's happening to you and help you be accountable for who Jesus calls you to be. It is within us that the transformation must begin. If it doesn't begin there, it doesn't go anywhere. And it is in knowing this Jesus whom we worship that the potential for that transformation is there. We hold within us, nobody can argue, the potential for all kinds of evil and misdeeds. Jesus recognized it and laid it out for us. But our hearts and our life don't make any sense to us until we meet Him and walk with Him, begin to walk with Him life's journey. I invite you to do so, beginning today, but don't do it alone. There are many who are sitting around you even now who want to share that journey with you and can walk the way of faith with you. Let it be so. Amen.